Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It is so good to have you back here and to do church history, to discuss church history again today. Just briefly, right before we started the program, I said, Father's going to have to introduce this one because I'm looking at the title and I would just, you know, I'm German all the way through, but I'm not going to be able to do this one.
Okay, well, it's a word with two umlauts in it. So the word is Götterdämmerung.
Götterdämmerung.
Götterdämmerung, the twilight of the gods.
Okay.
In fact, Wagner had written one of his operas named Götterdämmerung. But this really is the twilight of the gods, the twilight of the Roman gods.
Right.
We've seen already that the victorious Constantine at Saxa Rosa, or what's now nowadays called the Battle of Mulvian Bridge, frees then any chance of repercussions of new persecutions in the West. Christianity is freed from that that fear. Now we're going to see it happen now in the East also, of events that take place. I think last time we left off with that victory, and then at the same time an alliance between two of the emperors, between Constantine on the one hand and Licinius on the other.
Right.
Remember that there was a marriage involved in this and all, but there was a little bit of lining of that beautiful light cloud of a little bit of darkness coming, and that was the other emperor who was bringing a great army against Licinius, and this, of course, is the other emperor Maximin.
Mm-hmm.
And Maximin had been, I remember, a relative of Galerius. He is a persecutor of Christians, and if he wins, the East now is going to go through yet another terrible persecution. Well, what happens is he takes his big army. He crosses over the Bosporus Straits, which is that little section between Europe and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Turkey, right there. And he takes the town of Byzantium. That's a little port town. And then Heraclea takes that also, continues working in. Word has come that he also is playing the god game. He has promised to the god Jupiter that if victory comes, that he will dedicate the Roman Empire to Jupiter.
Oh.
And so his his soldiers are all jazzed up on that, and he has also promised Jupiter that in exchange for the victory, that he will destroy Christianity. He will do to Christianity what Diocletian almost did.
Oh,
he'll finish
wow.
the job. Well, so this is big stuff. The other side of this is Licinius. Now, Licinius is not a Christian, and his army is basically not Christian either, but word went throughout the Licinius's army that you might not be Christian, although there are a lot of Christians in that army.
Mm-hmm.
This might not be a Christian army, but it's allied to a Christian army. And so they're kind of excited too because of the victory that had happened at Saxa Rubra.
Mm-hmm.
God is on their side, and this is the real God.
Mm-hmm.
None of these fake gods like Jupiter. And on top of this, Licinius actually writes a prayer to the Christian God. And when the two armies, if you can imagine this, the two armies are coming at each other marching, one army stopped. Licinius's army stopped. The army went to its knees, and they all read the prayer that Licinius had written.
Wow.
To Christ. That spooked the other army. It's like, uh-oh. What's going on here? Got a prayer for Jupiter? No. So the two armies actually converge in the area of Thrace around Adrianople, and this battle takes place. At first, there had been an attempt between the two emperors to have some sort of a parley without anyone dying. You know,
mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can work this. Couldn't do it. And so the battle then is commenced. It is a huge victory for Licinius. Maximin is his army, although it's much larger and more powerful, is just overwhelmed. And military historians would say that it was probably the psychological factor of seeing Licinius's soldiers pray before they went into battle that caused the other side to blink. And so they begin to fall apart. The emperor's own bodyguard deserted him.
Wow.
And he was basically left by himself. So what he did was he tore off all of his imperial robes, put on a slave's outfit, and escaped undercover. He covered 160 miles in 2 days.
Wow.
I mean, that's really fast.
That's
back then,
very fast.
You know, and so, you know, doing 80 miles a day, he gets back to the capital, Nicomedia, and there he grabs his family, and they make for a rugged part of Asia Minor. It's called Cappadocia.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And so his hope is to hide out in Cappadocia, to raise another army, relying on Syria in order to bring this army up. However, Licinius is not going to sit back and watch him do that. He pursued him right into the hill country of Cappadocia. And so he begins fleeing again. And this time he fled to the port city of Tarsus, where St. Paul was from.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so Maximin now is being pursued. He can't raise an army. He knows that. He knows that everything is lost, and so he takes poison.
Oh.
He tries to kill himself. However, he botched it, and what happens instead is over the next couple of days, he died a very, very terrible death.
Slow and painful death.
Slow and painful. And we know this from both Eusebius, the historian Eusebius, and from Lactantius, the other historian who speaks about this. Licinius arrives in Tarsus. Now, I said he's not a Christian. Okay. And what he did next is obviously not what a Christian would do. He executed Maximin's wife.
Wow.
Then he turned around and executed his children.
Man.
He took all of the assistants, the aides, the governors, all of the pagan priests, even an engineer. This fellow had invented a statue that spoke. It's called the Zeus Philios statue, and it was a mechanical marvel. Because you could ask it a question, and the mouth would move, and the voice would come out, and it puffs of smoke, and all this kind of stuff.
Oh my gosh!
It was quite an extraordinary thing. The man's name is Theotechnos, the engineer, and I don't know if that's his real name. Theotechnos would mean the god worker, the maker of the god.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that's a nickname or something. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that he's put to death too. Licinius was just cleaning house, and then he turns around and even takes the daughter of Diocletian, and that's Valeria, and her mother, Prisca, and has them executed too.
Wow.
And this was just terrible. Diocletian himself is, remember, he's up in his villa, he's raising cabbages and, you know, living out a miserable life when he finds out that his own wife and daughter now have been murdered also. And so we understand one Roman historian by the name of Aurelius Victor said that at that point Diocletian totally gave up on life, and he literally stopped eating, and he starved himself to death. So he dies in December of 316. Pretty miserable,
right?
End to his life. Now, as we're looking at this, the tetrarchy, the four emperors, are now down to two emperors.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In the west, you have Constantine. Mm-hmm. In the east, now Licinius. The two of them are allies.
Right.
And so everything seems as though it's going to be fine. However, there are changes that are taking place, especially in the west. Now that Constantine takes over the city of Rome, and the entire Western Empire is under his control, and he has, along with Licinius, promulgated the Edict of Milan, which legalized Christianity. Did not make it the official religion, it just legalized it. However, he went further than that and began gifting the church in various ways. He himself is not a Catholic at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, his mother is, but he's not. And so bishops themselves were given a civil rank of that of a magistrate. And so now bishops, rather than being hounded by the state and persecuted, are now given a position of honor. There are laws, this sounds strange, but these laws go back for centuries in Rome, especially against celibacy. Octavian tried to make the Romans have more children, and so it was against the law to be a celibate in Rome. And so these laws were now overturned so that that priests and bishops and deacons could be celibate legally. Okay. I think that also says something to us about the fact that celibacy was practiced among the Roman clergy, or the Catholic clergy of the Western world. Gladiatorial games were disbanded. However, horse racing was not. It was very, very popular, and so they weren't going to do that. But the gladiatorial games, so the idea, the bloodlust games of killing people for entertainment was now done away with. There were also laws that were passed by Constantine that protected widows and orphans, protected women in general, particularly against rape and against prostitution. There were also laws passed against exposing babies. I remember this was a common Roman practice.
Right.
If you didn't want a baby.
On the banks of the river.
Yeah. And so that was done away with. Crucifixion was abolished. So these are a whole series of laws that are passed that in and of themselves are just moral. But you can see where Christianity is informing society,
right,
and causing good and humane laws to be passed, and so those things happen. Various temples that are dedicated to fertility cults are closed down. Also, you know, they are for all practical purposes houses of prostitution, and so he closes those down. Also, magic and soothsaying, which the Romans are really big on, had now to be done in public. It could not be done in private homes, and so it would be exposed to the ridicule of the public at that point. So I think what we're seeing then is a change of society. Here we have society penetrated by Christianity and to the good of society. However, and we have to always remember this, that sometimes society also penetrates the church, and that's not always a healthy thing.
Right.
And what we're going to see then is very rapidly some very right on targeted criticism of some of the things that are happening among churchmen. For instance, what we found is that immediately Constantine makes priests and deacons and bishops, of course, tax exempt.
Okay.
Guess what? That encouraged vocations.
Oh.
People became, they showed up in droves in order to become priests, you know. There's no seminary process at this point. That's a modern invention.
Mm-hmm.
You also had people making public displays of Christianity, which were simply not heartfelt. In business deals. If you're trying to get something out of the imperial favor, it helps you if you show your Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same sort of a thing that, you know, people join fraternal organizations in order to have those contacts.
Right.
Yeah, and this would be similar to that.
Okay.
It's just, it happens. And it has to be very discouraging to the Desert Fathers.
No,
it's one
yeah.
of the reasons why the Desert Fathers are
went
in the
to
desert.
The desert. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually there had to be a law that restricted, there was a law passed in Rome that restricted the number of ordinations. You know, There were also laws that restricted basically confidence men from setting up fake charities. What they were doing was these were Romans who would go ahead, they'd get themselves ordained, or maybe even not, and they would set up these charities. We're going to take care of the orphans or whatever, and then they're skimming money off of their fundraising. Yeah, I mean, this is...
No.
Yeah, it is. I mean, a bunch of Romans running around with big hair, and preaching the gospel and raising money as a result. Some things never change.
That's right.
They even had to have a law that restricted the clergy from receiving an inheritance from non-relatives. St. Jerome, in fact, mentions of that law, and he says it's a sad commentary on the state of affairs in the church itself. So there's nobody who's overseeing or governing these operations, and quite honestly, the same thing is true today. I'm not talking about the Catholic Church. I think canon law is very clear on these things, and there are abuses, but generally speaking, you find yourself in the chancery office trying to explain yourself when you do these things. But that's not true about a lot of other denominations.
Right.
You know, a couple decades ago when I was studying business law, my business law professor, who was not a Catholic, mentioned that his particular minister in his particular denomination asked him to draw up a standard will, a generic will. And he said, for what? And he said, well, families call me at the time of the mortal illness of their relatives, and if I can spend some time with them shortly before they die, I can go ahead and get them to change their will, and I'll substitute this will, and they'll will their money and their property to the church, meaning that denomination,
right.
and him.
Uh-huh.
Well, the long and short of it was that this particular law professor left that church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't going to have anything to do with this guy. Well, that's in the 1980s. So, and we know that this stuff continues on today. So we're seeing the same thing in the 300s within the church itself. People are going to have to there's going to have to be some oversight.
Right.
On that. Then there are also other problems that are popping up. The Donatists, which we've said a few things about before, are going to come back again with a vengeance. And then also a particular priest who's running around preaching, very, very popular, man by the name of Father Arius.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so these are going to be issues that he's going to have to deal with too. Before we get to any of that, though, Constantine has to deal with yet another very sad affair. It's a family affair. A lot of his family affairs are not very happy. And in this particular case, he found a young man that he thought would be a wonderful son-in-law. And so he gave his... It was actually a brother-in-law. He gave his sister Anastasia to him in marriage. His name is Basilianus, and Basilianus is he gets all kinds of favors in this wedding. For one thing, it's proposed that he be raised to the rank of Caesar, which means that his brother-in-law Constantine is basically giving him the western part of the empire at the time of Constantine's death.
Right.
Over his own sons, you know, he's really taken with this young man. Immediately, he would give to Basilianus Bassianus. It's Bassianus. Bassianus. He proposed giving to him Italy and Illyricum, which is basically both sides of the Adriatic Sea. And he would have that to administer right from the beginning. The one problem on this is that Illyricum, what used to be Yugoslavia, wasn't his to give.
Oh.
It was actually Licinius. And he didn't ask Licinius about this. Well, anyway, before he had an opportunity to ask Licinius about this, it turns out that Bassianus made contact with Licinius, and he suggests that the two of them operate together to get rid of Constantine,
okay. Mm-hmm.
And that he would then become the emperor in the West. And Licinius says, oh, that's not a bad idea. I think we could work on this. And Constantine found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his brother-in-law executed. Now, Licinius is exposed.
Mm-hmm.
My dear friend, who just was about to stab me in the back. And what comes then is two battles between Constantine and Licinius. Illyricum then falls to Constantine, and so now he's on the eastern side of the empire. Now that could have been the end of the war right then and there. However, what happens is that Licinius then goes back to Nicomedia, and rather than deal with Constantine and rather than accept his loss, he turns on the Christians.
Oh.
Yeah. And we enter into one more persecution. And what he does here is, it's a quiet persecution. And what he does is he simply quietly dismisses Christians from the army, from the court system. He goes to individual churches and Christian communities and extorts money from them. All of this leads to apostasies. It leads to people fleeing into the hinterlands like before, and one more incredible martyrdom. And I just want to talk about this. Guess what? It has to do with the 12th Legion.
Oh my gosh!
Remember those guys?
Yes.
Yeah. They had been involved in the siege of Jerusalem back when we first started this program. They were involved. Remember, they're called the Fulminata because of the lightning strikes that saved them against the Germans during that one battle. And here they are again. Now, the 12th Legion happened to be assigned to an area of central what is today Turkey. It's actually Armenia. And many of the soldiers in the 12th Legion are Armenians. And we have to remember that Armenia is the very first country to adopt Christianity as a country.
Wow.
The very first nation to adopt Christianity is Armenia. And so many of these Armenians then are in the Legion, in the 12th Legion, and they're assigned, they're posted at the city of Sevaste. Okay? And what happens is that when the orders get from Licinius to the 12th Legion, they're all called together and they're told, okay, now you're going to sacrifice to the Roman gods. And basically they refused.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them refused. 40 soldiers were hauled out of the numbers. 40 of them were selected. And each of them around 20 years old. And they were all thrown into prison. Now the question was, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to do this? This was in the dead of winter, and the 40 soldiers who had been put into prison were then condemned to die, and the way that they would be killed would be that they would be chained together and then put into a frozen lake. Okay, mm-hmm. And so there was this lake there. That was not very far away from the baths of Sebaste. That you have, you know, the Roman baths. There are three. You've got the cold water bath and the middle water bath, the tepid bath, and then the hot water bath. The caldarium, which is the same thing as a hot tub,
mm-hmm.
It's much bigger than our hot tubs. And there they were, within eyesight of the caldarium, and they're put into this lake. Which is freezing, and naked. They're put in there naked, and they're freezing. What happens is that one of them just can't take it. And so the others are all shouting to each other, encouraging each other. But one of them can't take it, and as he crawls out of the lake, the guards there freed him. They took the chains off of him, and he made his way into the Caladarium, crawling, because he was so, you know, the frostbite was so bad. And he reached the hot air of the Caladarium and died.
He died, right.
Yeah. So anyway, this is a really extraordinary thing. So now you got 39 rather than 40. One of the guards tore off his uniform and shouted that he too was a Christian and went running into the lake to be with the others who were dying.
That is, there's a painting of that, isn't that somewhere?
It's on our website.
I know there's a picture of it. That's right. It's on the website.
Yeah, that's the icon that I use for the early church history.
Yes,
so when you go to the website, you've got the four icons, and the one in the upper left-hand corner are the Martyrs of Sebaste.
Sebaste.
Yeah.
And that website is MichaelJohnWitt.com.
Com. Yeah.
I always want to put org first, and I think, no, it always says it's .com.
.com. I wanted .gov.
That's what makes me always stop, because I think about you saying that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, what happens is the next morning, all of them are dead except one man, one 20-year-old man.
He's still
actually
alive.
But here's the interesting thing that goes. The guards came out then, and they had a cart, and they pulled these bodies one after another out of that lake and piled them into this cart. And the last one who was still alive was brought out, and they didn't know what to do with him. And his mother came over and helped him to the cart to be with the others, and he died in her arms. It was a pieta experience. Just absolutely incredible. This whole event is known as the Veneration of the 40 Martyrs, and as I say, or as you mentioned, it was so impressive to me that that's why I chose that picture for the icon for for the website. There is, in fact, in Rome, a fresco of the experience, also at the Church of Saint Mary Antigua. And you can see that. It's this based upon eyewitnesses. This comes from a passion. So these are eyewitnesses who commemorate this this particular death. Well, so while Licinius is busying himself persecuting Christians and then also preparing himself for another war with Constantine, and he's getting this army together to go after Constantine, who shows up but the Goths? They cross over the Danube River and begin invading into Roman territory. Now, this territory is Licinius's.
Okay.
He's supposed to defend the border there. He's not.
Mm-hmm.
He's down preparing an army to attack the other emperor.
Mm-hmm.
So what does Constantine do? He knows that this guy is preparing an army against him. He uses his own army to defend Licinius's territory.
Wow.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, the end result is Licinius is embarrassed by this and insulted. He considers this an insult.
But he didn't consider it an insult that they were just going to destroy Rome, huh?
Well, not Rome, but he's in the East. Yeah,
right, okay.
He's in the East. At this time, also, Constantine sends back to Rome and has that banner, the Librum, that we mentioned that
right.
he used at the Battle of Saxaruba. That banner is brought forward also with his army so that, again, it would help to inspire his soldiers. Well, the Goths are defeated, okay? His soldiers are exhausted. Licinius uses that as an opportunity to attack. And so they meet in the in almost the same battlefield that Licinius had defeated Maximin.
Okay.
You know. However, this time around, Licinius is not relying upon the Christian God for victory, obviously, and Constantine is.
Mm-hmm.
The battle takes place. Licinius loses. He retreats down to Byzantium, And his intention then is to cross over Byzantium, cross over the Bosporus, make his way into Asia Minor, and basically try to do the same thing that Maximinus had done,
mm-hmm.
and try to rally troops. Well, what happens instead is that Constantine's son, Crispus, has a fleet, and he brings the fleet around and bottles up the little town of Byzantium. And so, as a result of this, then Licinius is captured.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Constantia goes to Constantine and pleads for Licinius's life. Okay. And he agrees. And he says, Constantine says, that he's going to send Licinius to Thessalonica, and he would be in exile for the rest of his life. He could live out his life in Thessalonica at government expense, and you know, and that would be fine. And then it turns out that that Licinius, before he's sent off, makes some contact with assassins to try to have Constantine killed.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. Well, anyway, this is in 324, and all we know is we don't know anything after this. Licinius' name is just never...
It's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. that's that memoria...
The wiping out.
Yeah, the damnatio memoria.
Uh-huh.
Well, he disappeared, let's put it that way. now Constantine is the only ruler of the Roman Empire from mm-hmm. end to end. Here's a chance to build his own legacy. And he's going to do this particularly around a city. He's going to build a city that he's going to name after himself. That, of course, is Constantinopolis, or we know it as Constantinople,
mm-hmm.
Istanbul. He also, besides building his own city, his mother is very interested in the Holy Land and going down there. Now, this is an area that has been neglected for the last 200, 300 years. It's just been just sort of sitting there. She wants to go, and she wants to find the spots of Jesus's life. She wants to know where was he born, specifically. She mm-hmm. wants to know where was he buried, where was the crucifixion, where did that take place, and so she's going to go there, and she's going to get a lot of really good answers, because the reality is we know where those sites are. The Christians had commemorated those sites from the very beginning, the very first generation and second generation, and then those sites were destroyed,
mm-hmm.
and the Romans came in and they put up pagan sites on top of these Christian sites. So we know exactly where these sites were, because the Romans thought that they were insulting Christianity by putting up these false gods.
By unmarking them, they marked them for us.
Got it. That's exactly right. Yeah, so there. And then the other thing that Constantine decided he's going to do, he could do this, after all, he's emperor of everything, he's going to solve all the church's problems. Good luck. He had already put his finger in the meat grinder earlier on when he tried to solve the Donatist problem. Interesting situation there. All of this really is goes back to one man. His name is Donatus of Casse Negre, and it's a small town in North Africa, in Nubia. He had accused the bishop of this area of apostasy. Now, here's the situation with this. This is Bishop Mensurius. And you might remember during the Diocletian persecutions, I had mentioned that there was a bishop who had been visited by the police, and that they had insisted that he turn over all the holy books. And remember that he had one of the best libraries of heretics in the world.
Right.
And so he turned over all those heretical writings instead. This
uh-huh.
is Bishop Mensurius.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Anyway, it turns out that Donatus is claiming that he was an apostate because he turned over these books. He should have taken it in the neck. He should have died for the cause. He used stealth in order to save his life. Yeah, some of these, remember, these guys are real rigorous.
Right, I understand.
Well, it gets more and more complicated.
Okay, so I understand so far.
Okay, yeah. Anyway, what we have then is that while you have Donatus mm-hmm. accusing his bishop of apostasy, you also have another city, the city of Cirta, in which is also nearby. And this is a city, if you remember, I think I mentioned in passing, where all of the priests caved in. They all apostatized at that time. And so the question was the replacement of the bishop there, which is Bishop Paul. And so this meeting takes place in 305. And the whole argument is going to be over whether he should be, how are you going to punish a bishop who apostatized?
Mm-hmm.
And basically the idea was that he would simply be replaced. He would not be brought back in. And so bishops came from throughout North Africa in order to do this, form together this synod. Well, Bishop Mensurius, okay, is not taking all of this lying down,
mm-hmm.
and he's seeing what's happening in this other diocese nearby. He calls the rigorists, he calls them fanatics and idiots, and the only thing that leads to the end of that argument is his own death. He eventually just died a natural death. But with his death, and you see that you've got, you know, these two sides that are arguing, first of all over him and then over this Bishop Paul. The next question is, who is going to become the next bishop?
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to replace Mensurius? And he has a deacon who is very popular among many of the people. His name is Caecilian.
Okay.
And Caecilian is elected by the diocese, by the priests and the deacons, to become the next bishop.
Okay.
Remember that there is no the kind of succession that we have today with apostolic mandates and all that. That develops much later on. Typically, a bishop became a bishop because his presbyterate elected him, and so they end up electing Caecilian. Now, he had a lot of experience earlier on, because as the deacon of that diocese, the assistant to the bishop, one of the things he was in charge of was taking care of the prisoners who were being persecuted. Deacons often did that. They were able to take food and sometimes other things to the Christians who were in these prisons,
okay.
And that was one of the things that he did. Okay, so he's elected. Then what happens is that three bishops of that area, three neighboring bishops, came to him and then consecrated him and installed him as bishop of that diocese.
Okay,
now that's another thing I think it's important for us to know, that bishops just didn't become bishops on their own. There is a collegiality we can see even in the early church, in which when a bishop becomes a bishop, other bishops come and install. And you can go beyond that, then the Bishop of Rome is involved in knowing about this and approving and all those sorts of things. That's for another day.
Okay,
but
great.
What happens is that Donatus and his followers object to Caecilian becoming this bishop and the installation. And there are a couple reasons for that. One reason is that when he was deacon and in charge of taking care of the prisoners, he was not even handed giving out the food
shares of whatever.
Shares. Basically, he argued that the fanatics, that is to say, those who came to the Roman government and said, "I'm a Christian, persecute me," he didn't think that they were worthy to receive as much as the others. And so there was a little favoritism that was performed in there. He was clearly trying to show that a Christian's duty is to preserve his life as best he can. We've talked about this many times. And these guys were actually volunteering to die. And that's not what you do as a Christian. Well, anyway, so they held that against him. Then, on top of that, they also hold against the three bishops who had come to consecrate him. They claimed that they were lapsi themselves. Now, it turns out that they weren't.
Right.
But that was the argument, that they were. Now, at this point, this becomes a real contentious issue, because the city that Cecilian is now the bishop of is no mean city. It's the city of Carthage.
Wow.
And so this is a very important diocese.
Mm-hmm.
This means that he is also the primate, the most important bishop of North Africa. Outside of Alexandria, this is a very important diocese. And so the bishops then, all of the bishops, because they felt that the church was going into schism between these groups, they came together at Carthage, okay, these various bishops, and they first of all, they had these bishops who show up at this synod. They're not called, by the way. They came on their own.
Mm-hmm.
They come to Carthage. They're also made up mainly of bishops who had condemned Bishop Paul in Cirta and made him resign. And now they come together in this synod where they're going to solve this problem. And, you know, the Bishop Cecilian says, well, what problem are you talking about? And they said, we're going to decide whether or not you really should be the Bishop of Carthage or not. Well, he objected to that pretty pretty vigorously, as you can imagine. This brings us then to a theological point, which is important to keep in mind also. And it has to do with the validity of a sacrament that is dependent or independent of the sanctity of the priest involved.
Okay.
Now, the Donatists are going to argue that that the priest is the conveyor of grace, and therefore he must be grace-filled in mm-hmm. order to convey the grace. On the other hand, the Orthodox position is that it's the sacrament that conveys the grace. It's not the conveyor, the priest who's confecting the Eucharist, who's forgiving sins. It's possible for a priest to hear confessions, and he himself might be in sin, and yet the sacrament is still valid.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the issue that was being fought out over this particular synod, and there were some 70 bishops, 70, who showed up for this. And the argument is made for the Donatist position, but in the end, the bishops themselves agree that that the theology is not on the side of the Donatists. And so that happens. Then the Donatists turn around and they name the three bishops who had consecrated Cecilius as being lapsi bishops. And again, this time around, they're able to put forward evidence that they had not lapsed. And so again, the Donatists lose.
Dismiss them. Uh-huh.
But 70 bishops who were gathered there want to throw some sort of a bone to the Donatists.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was they then turned to Bishop Cecilian,
okay,
and said, we're going to annul your installation. We're going to make you not bishop. And then all 70 of us will reconsecrate you.
Oh, okay.
Anyway... it didn't turn out that way.
Oh.
What happened was they annulled the position of Cecilian.
Okay.
I don't know whether you can do that.
That was my thought.
Yeah, I've got some real issues with that too. But when it came then for him to be reelected by the 70, it turned out that there was a lot of campaigning going on, and they turned and did not reelect him.
Mm.
Instead, they turned to a lector. This is a guy that, you know, just reads the scriptures,
right.
Okay? Now, his name is Majorianus, okay? And he ends up winning in this Synod of 70, because the fact of the matter is that there was a campaign that was a very aggressive political campaign, and there was a lot of heavy financing that was being done by a woman from Carthage. Now, her name is Lucilla.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Now, I got to set this up. Remember that when Cecilian was a deacon?
Yes.
Okay. He was a little controversial, certainly with the rigorists. Okay. Uh-huh. But it turns out that one day, this very wealthy woman, Lucilla, came forward to receive communion, as she always does. And she had used her money earlier on to buy a relic of a martyr. And it was her habit, when she came forward to receive communion, that before she would receive communion, she would kiss the relic and then receive communion.
Okay.
Okay. When he was deacon administering the Eucharist, when she came forward and did that, he told her that she should not do that, and he would not give her communion unless she put the relic away and stopped doing that. Well, she considered that an affront. After all, she's very wealthy. And what is he? Just a deacon. So she's been carrying this in her crawl all these years. And so when she sees now that he's been bishop and now he's been removed from bishop, that's why all that money begins flowing in to try to, and successfully, try to overcome the synod of bishops.
Wow.
This affair split the church into two parts. You had those who were supporting Donatus and other rigorists, and then the others were simply known as the Catholics. And the Catholics are those who are still supporting Cecilian. This was a legitimate, valid ordination and consecration of a bishop. Mm-hmm. And you can't remove a bishop like that out of... this did happen from time to time. We have to understand that. And eventually there was a council that decided that if the priests of a diocese remove their bishop, the bishop has the right to appeal to the Pope in order to for him to make that that judgment. But this is a later council. This is so we don't have any of that set up at that time. So what happens instead is that because of the split that happens, the Donatists turn to Constantine and ask him to make a judgment as to whether Cecilian should be the bishop, or rather their candidate, Majorinus, should be the bishop. Constantine then turns around and he asks three bishops from Gaul, France, to go to Rome. And under the presidency of Pope Miltiades, that they should choose the case. They should hear the case. Well, that's exactly what happens. However, Pope Miltiades also invited a number of Italian bishops to come in and join. And so it now becomes what had been a court of three under the presidency of the Pope, now becomes a synod of 19 under the presidency of the Pope. And he's one of the 19.
Okay.
This is all held, this synod is held at the Lateran, at the Domus Fauste, and it's in October of 313. Both sides are allowed to speak. The evidence is heard, and the arguments are made for 3 days straight. And each of the bishops who spoke, every one of them favored Cecilian. The last one to speak was Pope Miltiades himself, and he said this: "I believe that he, Cecilian, ought to be left with the right of ecclesiastical communion and dignity of office." That's it. Rome has spoken. Causa finita est, right?
Right.
Not for the Donatists. So the Donatists, they are angry at this. The Pope goes on further to say that where you have a diocese in which there are two bishops, a Donatist bishop and a Catholic bishop, the Donatist bishop should retire. He's not arguing against the validity of the sacrament of the ordination of the bishop itself, but he's saying he should retire. The Catholic bishop should take over the diocese and run the diocese. If, however, there is not a Catholic bishop, or if the Catholic bishop dies or retires, then the Donatist bishop would take over the diocese and be the ordinary of that diocese. And for those Donatist bishops who do not have dioceses, then they would look around North Africa and find a diocese for them. Mm-hmm. So that's the compromise that's intended. And the whole idea is then to bring an end to the schism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. However, the Donatists go back to Africa. They're very upset about all of this, and they refer to themselves as being the Church of the Martyrs. They don't call the Catholics Catholics. They call them the Church of the Traditores, of the traitors. And what leads, this leads to civil unrest. It leads to fights, seizing of property, quarrels that get down into the court system over ownership of property. This just goes on. So another synod is called. Again, Constantine's trying to solve this, and this time it's in Arles in France, up in France, and again it's Constantine who's trying to solve this. 10 months after the Roman Synod, now you have this other one in Arles in France. This time 45 bishops are brought in. This is all done at state expense. Constantine's paying for all of this. And the results are the same. The bishops said, no, the Donatists were wrong. They're in schism. And finally then excommunication takes place, and they're excommunicated. Also, along with that, there are some 22 canons that cover the Lapsi controversy.
Wow.
Anyhow, what happens then is the Donatists, as being good schismatics, they refuse to accept this, mm-hmm. and they dig in their feet. They're caught in lies. There are forged documents that they've been involved in. Again, Constantine sends two bishops down in 316 down to North Africa to try to bring about peace. Again, they're rebuffed. Things are going absolutely nowhere. However, the Catholic Church all throughout is standing by Rome and standing by the decision that had been made by Pope Miltiades mm-hmm. in his synod. And now Constantine finally sees the Donatists for what they are, as being rebels. And so he begins using the state against them. But Teresa, this is persecution.
Mm-hmm.
He's persecuting Christians. Now, they might be schismatic Christians, but he's doing the very same thing that he wanted not to do.
Right.
He's seizing churches. He's seizing property. At the same time, the Donatists are goading him by attacking Catholic churches, disrupting masses,
wow.
you know, and they spread their schism all throughout the world because they're fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are real rigorous, you know. So what you end up having is no solution to the Donatists. In the next couple generations, St. Augustine's still going to be dealing with them.
Right.
You know, Constantine then has a real failure. He's got a failure in trying to bring about Christian unity through his means. That's going to have to come about in a different way. It's going to have to come about through a council, and they're going through a creed. We know it was as the Nicene Creed. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But he's got that problem to deal with, and then also his family. We'll talk a little bit about that later too, and the disasters within his own family. But he turns his attention to the one thing he can really do, and that's going to be to build a great city. And this city is going to be named after him, but it is going to be established on Christian lines. If there ever is going to be a city of God, St. Augustine's term, he meant Constantinopolis to be that city. And one of the ways of doing that is a magnificent church that's going to be built there, the Hagia Sophia. I don't know if we have time to talk about that city. We can talk about it maybe next time around.
Let's do.
Okay. Because it's worth describing.
Right. And I hate to cut it short.
Yeah.
So let's do that. So shall we close with a prayer and a
blessing? Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.